The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the RoadWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, brought to you by Rival Fantasy. I'm your host, James Anderson, and as promised, this week's episode is just going to be a mailbag episode. I'm sure you're used to those by now. Final Wednesday of every month, I'll do one of these. And I planned on getting to as many questions as I could, and I thought I might be able to get to all of them. And then I saw how many you guys asked, and I realized this afternoon I wasn't going to be able to get to all of them on the pod. I will get to about 95% of them on the article version, which will go up Thursday, but just not going to be able to fit them all into the podcast. Let's start things off with, I got a couple questions on Josh Jung, my buddy Rob DiPietro, pull hitter, Patreon, definitely recommend supporting what Rob's doing over there. It's great, really invaluable stuff for in-season management. And then Jason Erb also had a question about Josh Jung. Rob's question was, Josh Jung will finish 2023 as the blank ranked player on a 15-team auction calculator. And Jason asked if there's anything under the hood that would give you concern about Josh Jung, noting just how good he's looked so far. For Rob's question, I'll say Jung finishes as the 115th ranked player, 115, in a 15-team auction calculator. That's roughly where Matt Chapman finished last season, and Chapman was my comp for Jung coming into the year. To Jason's question, obviously Jung's contact rate and whiff rate, not ideal, but when you factor in the context, I think they're totally fine. He's a corner infielder who's getting to his game power, or getting the significant game power. So I don't think we should, this is not Jung's peak, right? We're a couple of years away probably from Josh Jung's peak. And this is just a really strong start to his rookie season. I'd expect him to just kind of continue to refine the approach in the coming years, and he'll probably peak in a couple of years. And my comp was to sort of 2022 Matt Chapman, not whatever this 2023 version is of Matt Chapman, but Jung could eventually be one of the top third basemen for fantasy, and he's out already a guy that you're starting in all your formats. Mike Sheets asks, what's the realistic timetable for Heston Kjerstad? Could he be up this year if the O's deal with injuries? So fortunately for those who have Kjerstad in Dynasty, he's played as many games at first base as he has in right field this year. So he's also playing DH. So there's several avenues to playing time here for Kjerstad long term, even in this super crowded organization. But if you look at the org chart just for 2023, Colton Cowser, Kyle Stowers, they're kind of the obvious outfield options at AAA if the Orioles deal with injuries or trade a guy or just take playing time away from a guy. So a lot would have to happen, I think, both with Kjerstad just really banging down the door. He hasn't even gotten a AAA yet. So he would have to really force the issue, and I think they'd have to have probably multiple injuries for him to get a look in the outfield this year. He's not on the 40-man roster. I think it's more likely that when they go to select a contract of one of their top prospects, it's Kauser or it's Jordan Westberg who gets added to the 40-man roster this season. So they have such a crowded situation, and we've got more questions about that. Feels like every one of these episodes, there's some sort of question about how all these Orioles players are going to get playing time. But yeah, I think Kjerstad's more of, it's a good story how good he's been this year, kind of capitalizing on his, or building off of his run in the Arizona Fall League. But I think Kjerstad's just more of a 2024 guy. The fact that he's playing first base, you know, half the time at AAA, and I look at, you know, Kauser, Stowers, Hayes, and Mullins have been great this year. His long-term home might be just a combination of first base and DH, and he might get platooned. Eric Halterman, a co-worker here at RotoWire, he says when a prospect gets called up unusually quickly, like Mason Miller or Zach Neto, and we have much less statistical data than we're used to, what factors push you towards his team must know something versus this guy is obviously not ready yet? So I think it's pretty rare for a legitimate prospect to get the call and for it to be clear from the outside that they're not ready. It happens sometimes, but usually we just don't have enough to say he's definitely not ready. We could say he's probably not ready. I think we should look at the context with every one of these players. With Miller and Neto specifically, it's kind of clear reasons that you can sort of see from the team standpoint why they got the call when they did. The A's rotation is terrible, and Miller's short-term and long-term health are far from guaranteed. So why not just get him into the big league rotation as soon as he could reasonably be expected to hold his own? You know, they're obviously not going to do anything this year as a team, but it doesn't make any sense to just keep a guy in the minors who, you know, Miller could suffer another serious injury at any point, right? So if he's already one of the, you know, two or three best pitchers in the entire organization, most big league ready pitchers for a rotation in the entire organization, why not just get him up to the big leagues? And with pitchers, we have so much crucial data at our disposal with these guys, AAA data, spring training games, when we're talking about this early in the season. I don't think you need a ton of data on a pitcher to kind of get a sense of just how ready they are from a stuff standpoint. You're never going to know if a guy has it mentally to kind of be a big league starter. That's just such a mental grind. But, you wouldn't be able to tell that from a guy, even if you saw like 30 starts of them at AAA. You're not going to know if they're going to be able to handle it in the big league. So we're able to look at a guy like Mason Miller's stuff, and we know how good it is, even if it's only been a handful of starts, factoring in like spring training, upper levels, and everything like that. And then with position players, it's definitely different. It's much less kind of like, here are the pitches, here's the command. He should be pretty solid, or he should get lit up. With hitters, it's just so tough. But, you know, projecting a hit tool of a guy at AA to the big leagues is one of the toughest things you can do when you're prospecting. But with the Angels, we sort of knew what they were doing before they did it. We didn't know they were going to do it this early, but they went into the season without a viable everyday shortstop. Everyone knew that. We could all look at the depth chart and be like, who's going to play shortstop for these guys? So they kind of told us before the season that this was the plan. It definitely happened sooner than anyone anticipated, I think, but he had that red hot start at AA. They knew internally that at some point he was going to get the job, and they were just like, let's just do it now. I said in Neto's preseason outlook that it would be surprising if he were better than league average if the Angels push him to the majors in his first full season as a pro. And I think that still applies. I definitely don't think you can look at Neto's amount of experience in pro ball, and I don't think you'll find like any scouting report where it's like this guy's gonna be ready to hit big league pitching right away. There were scouts who thought Michael Harris was ready last year when he got the call from AA, but there just wasn't enough there really with Neto for anyone to confidently say he was ready. And I think you should kind of cap the expectations on a guy like that at, you know, can he just sort of be good enough to stay in the majors and not get sent back down to AAA? I think Neto can be that good. But he got called up more because this was just part of the plan all along than the Angels just being like, oh my God, we got to get this guy to the big leagues. When it's a, to more to sort of Eric's question, generally, when it's a smart team with a strong track record, like last year with Atlanta, Michael Harris, maybe those surprise promotions can get more of the kind of they must know something qualification. But there's just, like we just talked about with Neto, with Miller, with each of these guys, there's just so much that we're looking at. We're looking at their performance. We're looking at the team context. We're looking at the injury track record. We're looking at the organizational depth chart, all that stuff. So it's definitely kind of a case-by-case thing. But I think with Miller and Neto, I thought it was clear that Miller's stuff was ready for prime time, just based on everything we saw. You know, the one start at AA, the one start at AAA, all the noise around him coming out of spring training and out of the Arizona Fall League last year. We didn't know. We don't know. We still don't know if he's going to be able to be a guy that's consistently going, you know, five plus innings. But I think it was pretty clear why he got the call when he did. And same thing with Neto. All right. I'm going to head to a quick message from the sponsors, but when I come back, I will answer the question that's on everyone's mind. What's going on here with Andrew Abbott?
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
A new MLB season means it's time for a new kind of daily fantasy baseball. Rival Fantasy is the fantasy platform reinventing the way daily and weekly games are played, and they've brought new games to the ballpark this year that fantasy players won't find anywhere else. Rival Fantasy's games include Fantasy Bingo, head-to-head player challenges, and Fantasy Book, where users can select over-unders for 2 to 5 players. With games like this, daily fantasy has never been better. Right now, RotoWire listeners can get a $50 protected first play. That means if you win your first play, you keep your winnings. But if you lose your first entry, Rival Fantasy will fully refund you up to $50. Go to play.rivalfantasy.com/signup and use the code RotoWireMLB at signup and deposit a minimum of $25 to get your first entry on Rival protected up to $50. Now's the time to step up to the plate and become a rival today. Welcome to the arena. Baseball is back, swing into the MLB season with Vivid Seats and score tickets to all the hottest matchups and biggest games of the year. Every crack of the bat, every deep center fly, and every heart-pounding double play of your favorite team, live and in person. Plus, with Vivid Seats rewards, now you earn rewards with every single ticket purchase. Each ticket you buy gets you closer to your reward. Just buy 10 tickets, then simply cash in your credit toward your 11th ticket purchase. It's that easy. Pro reward tip, buy tickets for your whole group, split the bill, and make progress towards your free 11th ticket even faster. From behind the plate to the upper deck, Vivid Seats has great tickets for all the 2023 games that matter to you. Just visit vividseats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. See vividseats.com/rewards for terms and conditions. All right, so I mentioned in my call for questions in that tweet, just basically, I don't want to get 10 questions about Andrew Abbott, so just consider that your Andrew Abbott question will get answered. He's definitely the person I've gotten the most questions about so far this month, and so I was going to address it regardless. Shouts to Reese White for sending in like the token tweet, so obviously the numbers for Andrew Abbott are really pretty ridiculous. Now, for what it's worth, two of the lineups that Abbott dominated at Double A after making 20 starts there last year were terrible lineups with zero top 400 prospects. Mississippi, the Atlanta Double A affiliate, and Tennessee, the Cubs Double A affiliate. Both of those rosters are just kind of as bad as, or lineups are as bad as you'll see at Double A. And then the other lineup he faced was Rocket City, in which Zach Nitto, basically the only kind of prospect who I would say is on Abbott's level in terms of a Double A performer that he faced in any of those three starts. Nitto went 1-for-3 with 2 walks. The rest of that lineup was pretty bad. Obviously Edgar Caro is a real prospect, but he's also a 20-year-old who jumped over high A. So basically all that to say that Abbott dominating those three lineups it's meaningful, like the way that he did it, the level of domination is meaningful, but I think it's worth noting that he really didn't face any real Double A caliber hitting prospects other than Zach Nitto in those three starts. But let's look at the stuff. So I reached out to my buddy Dylan White at Baseball America, just seeing what kind of data he's got on Abbott's pitches. And fastball's been sitting 93, touching 96. That's about up a tick, basically, on what he was last year. The Baseball America scouting report I saw for before the season, I think he was like 90 to 94. So sitting 93, touching 96, that's good. That's kind of the high end of where we could expect his fastball to be. There's no real projection left in Abbott's body at all. So any additional ticks of velo he gets will have to be via something else other than just kind of growing into it. So that's great. 40% whiffs on the fastball. That's crazy. 60% whiffs on his slider. That's even crazier. I think he's kind of optimized the low 80s slider to be more of a sweeper than it was maybe kind of in the middle of last year. Changeup and curveball are average ish. My instinct here is that, based on the amount of questions I've gotten about Abbott, is that he's probably a sell high in theory. Can you add a guy off waivers and then turn around and sell him high less than a month later? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can. I think this, like the month of April 2023, Abbott's Q rating is basically higher than it might ever be. Now, at the same time, the quality of his fastball and slider and the level of domination in a return trip to Double A, I think that's got him kind of in my head as sort of like a borderline top 100 prospect right now. So he's really improved his stock. And if you look at the Reds rotation, it's not that hard to envision him looking like their fourth best starting pitcher by like late May, early June. So there's some redraft potential here as well. Of course, pitching for the Reds, pitching half your games at Great American Ballpark, not the type of pitching prospect I'm going to be all over in Fab if and when he gets the call, but he's helped his prospect stock a ton this year already in just three starts at Double A. But I just think the amount of questions I'm getting about him has oversold sort of how excited we should actually be about Abbott for fantasy. My partner, Todd Whitestone, he's the Fab wizard of the NFBC teams that we co-manage together. He wants to know what's the best guess on the ETA for the two Gavins, Gavin Stone with the Dodgers, Gavin Williams with the Guardians, and how will they perform? So Stone and Williams, they'll have massive redraft appeal for me, and they should for you guys as well, if and when they get the call. Stone is coming off his best start of the year at AAA, and Williams just got the bump to AAA. So I kind of think they're both on track to debut roughly in June sometime. But, I mean, I think Gavin Williams could get big league hitters out today. I think Gavin Stone, if the changeup's working, like he had some kind of iffy starts early in the year. But the Gavin Stone we saw in spring training – and Gavin Williams we've seen this year at Double A, those are guys who are ready to get big league hitters out as starters. Like the team context with both guys, especially with Stone, obviously. So let's assume they both come up sometime in June. Looking at the rest of the pitching prospects that are out there, I think these might be the last two guys who are worth a triple-digit bid, a triple-digit Fab bid out of 1,000. So big time appeal if they get the call. And I'd guess we're probably six-ish weeks away from it happening for both these guys. But obviously it could be sooner, it could be later, based on a variety of factors. Last week's podcast guest, John Legaiza of MLB Moving Averages, asks which bad team prospect outfielder has the best chance of sticking in redraft. Alex Call and Stone Garrett with the Nationals, Connor Capel with the A's, Kerry Carpenter with the Tigers. You know, it's Carpenter for me. There's something to see there with Call and Garrett and Capel, but Carpenter's the only one of these guys I even considered, at the draft table. And I did take him as a starting outfielder for my main event team. So obviously I believe in Carpenter. He got his first start all year against the lefty yesterday, and he homered off Eric Lauer in Milwaukee. So that's a really good sign. He's primarily hit cleanup against righties. Now, Carpenter wasn't acquired by the current regime in Detroit, and he's not a good defender. He kind of belongs at DH. So they might not be loyal to him if he goes through some kind of extended slump. And, you know, obviously these sort of new school front offices, they aren't very interested in DH-only types. So they might not have acquired Kerry Carpenter in the first place, but you look at that roster. I mean, he's one of the only guys that has any argument to be hitting in the middle of a big league lineup. So I like Carpenter quite a bit. I like him even if he's only playing against righties. Like I said before the season, to Tigers fan and friend Nick Schlein. I said before the season to Schlein that he could hit 25 homers even if he's on the strong side of a platoon. I think Carpenter has legit mixed league appeal, whereas Call, Garrett, and Capel are more sort of guys that you stream in when they have seven games in a week or something like that. Okay, Eric Cembulski, friend of the show, friend in the industry, he wants to know, probably a bitter question here, will Brian Bayo have any redraft value this year? I think we'll hear from Bayo again. You know, he had two shaky starts to the big leagues, probably was rushed into the big league rotation. They didn't really need to do that, I don't think, but they did it anyway and pulled the plug. So I think Bayo, we probably see a AAA for, I don't know, 6 weeks, something like that, and then he's back up. So I think he'll be heard from again, but he's not the type of guy that you want to stash, I don't think, in seven-man bench leagues. And then Eric also wanted to know that with Ronnie Mauricio getting second-base reps now for the Mets AAA affiliate, When do we think he's up, and will he be viable in 12 or just 15 team leagues? So Mauricio's definitely helped his fantasy stock or dynasty stock significantly, just based on how much game power he's getting to. But the plate discipline is still it's very aggressive right now. He's not striking out too much, but he's not walking enough probably for me to have any faith in him having success against big league pitching in terms of batting average or OBP this year. He's just massive, Mauricio, by the way. I got to see him in person when I was down in Florida. And, we talk about projection a lot with prospects and physical projection. And Mauricio is just the epitome of what we're talking about. Like when he signed as a high pedigree 16-year-old, like he was just rail thin, and it was just kind of like, he's gonna grow into power. Everyone thinks he's gonna grow into power. I mean, he is massive now, so I'm not surprised at how much game power he's getting to. But if the Mets / Buck Showalter can't give Brett Beatty everyday playing time, and they can't give Francisco Alvarez more than a 50-50 split with Thomas Nito, it's hard to feel optimistic about Mauricio playing enough if and when he gets the call that we would want to use him even in 15 team leagues on a regular basis. Like, he would need to be playing pretty much every day to make up for the fact that he's probably like a one category guy. Like, you're basically just using him for the power if he gets up this year. So he's helped his dynasty stock a ton, Ronnie Mauricio. Just by the power hitter he's turned himself into. But I don't see him either playing enough or being good enough in terms of batting average to be all that useful this year. Could be wrong, though. Dandy F. Chiggins, I got a couple questions here about guys that people want to know if they should be patient with. Should everyone stay patient with Gunnar Henderson? Are you still as high on him as you ever were? Also, any Jordan Walker worries, or will he be fine? And then your name here says, it is getting more and more difficult holding both Gunnar Henderson and Anthony Volpe for their upside while having productive veterans get gobbled up off the waiver wire. How long do you hold such high upside players when other injuries and underperforming has plagued my team the first 3 weeks? So I am not anywhere near as optimistic about Gunnar Henderson for redraft as I was a month ago. Thankfully, I didn't end up with a ton of Gunnar Henderson in redraft, but I was open to taking him where he was going. And that I regretted having any Gunnar Henderson like a week into the season. It just became very obvious to me that that was a stupid pick. And it doesn't really mean anything about Henderson's long-term value, but he's not swinging the bat enough. And the park is bad. And, he's got issues against lefties. So it's just, he's a tough guy right now in redraft. I think you got to hold him. I don't think it's too actionable. I think you sit him where you can when they've got a bunch of lefties coming up or something like that. But it's not that actionable right now. Like, you can maybe buy low on Henderson in dynasty. I wouldn't recommend trading him right now in dynasty. I'm still going to have him ranked as a top 40 player for dynasty on next week's update. I don't think you can really drop him either in redraft. Like, maybe if it's a super shallow league and you just have a loaded corner infield situation, you're just never going to play him. Maybe you can move on from him, but I think you're just kind of stuck with Henderson in redraft right now. And there'll be brighter days ahead. Like, Henderson is so talented. He could go on just a monster tear in June and July or something, and you'll be feeling a lot better about it. But I think you're just kind of stuck with him in redraft and wouldn't recommend selling Henderson in dynasty right now. Jordan Walker, his batting average is actually higher right now than I expected it to be. He's hitting .274, but it should probably regress down from there. I would not be surprised if Walker got optioned to AAA sometime soon, just due to how crowded things are. Lars Nootbaar looks awesome. Like, Nootbaar is, like, I think Nootbaar is kind of turning into an absolute monster guy that you definitely want to have in dynasty. Maybe they could trade Tyler O'Neill and kind of loosen up this logjam a little bit, but I wouldn't be surprised if Walker goes back to AAA, and he's just not adding any value in the field at all. So that makes sense to me. So I'm not worried about Walker relative to my expectations, but I'm sure he's not doing as much damage as those who drafted him hoped he would. And then to the question from your name here, holding both Henderson and Volpe is just a perfect example of why you don't want to leave a draft with too many unproven hitters on the same roster, especially guys that you have to pay up for. Because you know, holding just Henderson or holding Volpe, that's not the end of the world. And I'd still feel fine starting both of those guys, Volpe especially, just based on how much he's running. But when you have both those guys, and I assume you're probably not starting them very often, and you can't scoop these guys up off waivers, I could see how that's very frustrating. I think they're both still top 300 players for redraft. So again, like I just don't see how you could drop them unless it's just like, I don't know what caliber guys are out there. Like, I don't think you should be kicking yourself for not dropping Gunnar Henderson for Brent Rooker or something like that. But yeah, it's just, that's partly why you just, there's nothing wrong with grabbing one prospect in a draft or maybe some flyers with your late picks, but you don't want to be taking two guys like this where you just don't really know what you're getting. And you had to use high pick on those guys unless you took Volpe earlier in draft season. Speaking of Brent Rooker, CJ Baseball asks if I'm buying Brent Rooker in deeper redraft leagues. Well, I haven't bought into Rooker in any leagues. If he was still out there in my deeper redraft leagues and I could add him, I would. He's a number three hitter who's red hot at the plate right now, and he's been playing against righties and lefties. So I think you could ride that in the short term if you got a spot in your lineup for him. But as soon as he starts sitting against most righties, or as soon as the strikeouts spike, and I kind of think both those things will happen at some point, then I think you got to burn and churn with Rooker. But you ride him while he's hot, ride him while he's playing and hitting high in that lineup every day. All right, Ted Morgan. If Jonathan Clase with the Mariners stays healthy this year, what is the chance he gets significant time in AA with a chance at AAA? What is a 75th percentile outcome for him? So Clase is playing at high A Everett, and Everett is an extreme hitter's park, as is Spokane. And those are the two parks where his four home runs have been hit. He's at an age-appropriate level, and he's striking out 29.3% of the time. And I think the 29.3% strikeout rate is going to sustain. I don't think that he's going to make massive improvements on that. But I do think the 412 BABIP is going to come way down. So, you know, Clase is playing over his head right now. When you factor in the park, when you factor in just the luck on balls in play. Now we're talking about a guy who's already on the 40-man roster, and I don't think he's ready for a jump to AA yet. So, you know, he probably gets the jump to AA at some point, even if he's not quite ready, just because he's already on the 40-man roster. I don't think they're going to keep him at high A all season. But I think his stats could go into the tank after the promotion to AA. Highly doubt he gets to AAA this year. And a 75th percentile outcome on Class A, I couldn't think of any like one-to-one comps that I thought were great, but I will say I think Class A he's closer to projecting as an Akil Baddoo type than many people would care to admit. So Class A is a pretty obvious sell high guy to me right now. Drew Wolf, Tamar Johnson's upside versus Junior Caminero's upside. Advantage Caminero. All right, Toolsy. Wilmer Flores, Detroit has struggled. I thought he was somewhat undervalued given his proximity, but now I have my doubts. What kind of projection do you have for him beyond 2023? So before the season, I said he could be an innings eating number four starter. In his outlook, I said that up on roadwire.com/pod for free trial. And that's still my projection, innings eating number four starter. You were probably too high on him before the season, but I still think he turns into a big league starter, and better days are probably ahead. I think, you know, he'll round into form. But I don't think we'll see him till 2024, most likely. Matt Mountain. Who are some batters outside of your top 150 to keep an eye on with high hit tool, low K rates, thinking about a head-to-head points league? So I used our really cool filters that are on the top 400 prospect rankings. Shouts to the tech team for putting all that together. But I basically filtered for guys outside of the top 150 with strikeout rates below 22%. Justin Henry Molloy with the Tigers is he's head-to-head points league gold. I would grab him immediately if he's available in your league, Matt. And I think Molloy will be heard from in redraft fairly soon. You look at the third baseman the Tigers have been starting this year, it's just terrible. So Molloy will be bid on in Fab in the coming weeks. And he's just been on fire at AAA. Luis Matos is technically qualified series outside my top 150. He's much better than that. Tyler Black is someone I got a question about. I'll talk a little bit more about him later. Sterling Thompson, another guy I'll talk a little bit more about later. Alec Burleson, Oslives Basabe, Justin Foscue, just a handful of guys who are outside my top 150 with high hit tools, low K rates per Matt's request. Robert Easton, what the heck is going on with Luis Matos? He's got an 8.2% K rate and a 16.4% walk rate at AA. On the flip side, he's not really hitting for a lot of power or stealing much. I continue to be intrigued, but I just don't have a clue what his true talent is. And then Joshua Roberts says, what do you think of Luis Matos' start to the year? Is he back? So probably the biggest trend I've noticed in all of baseball through the first month is just it's so clear that teams are really, really stressing swing decisions more than ever with their guys. And, you know, I'm sure they're using high-tech tools to help teach this stuff, but you can see it in the numbers. These guys that have just sky high walk rates all of a sudden. And they're, you know, a lot of the times it's guys that like Miguel Vargas, who's had high walk rates before, and then they like doubled this year. And Gunnar Henderson kind of fits that mold. Tristan Casas, Luis Matos, he was always more of an aggressive bat to ball guy, known for his bat speed, known for his athleticism. You know, I think if he'd sort of stayed on that trajectory, he was kind of trending towards maybe Manuel Margot being kind of his realistic ceiling. But if this high walk rate approach is sustainable for Matos, then he could be more of a leadoff hitter than like a number seven hitter. And I'm sure the Giants just stressed that to him, or someone got to him and really made him kind of take this approach this year, and it's really working for him. And it makes sense, right? Like if you've got big time bat speed, if you can just wait for pitches that you can drive rather than just putting everything in play, it makes a lot of sense. Now in terms of Matos's power and his speed, I don't really see any evidence at this point in time that he's more than like a 15 homer guy. But it's still super early. And then speed, you know, I don't think he's like a 30 steal guy, but he could be a 10 to 20 steal guy. No problem. It's just going to be interesting to see how long he can kind of sustain this current approach that, that Robert and Josh alluded to. It's too early after 15 games to say he's back, but he's a top 100 guy for sure. CJ, is now the time to sell high on James Outman in Dynasty? Maybe. Like, there could be trades out there where you'd be selling high and I'd be like, oh yeah, you got to take that. But I also think you could buy high on James Outman. It just, what's the market? Like, is there someone in your league who thinks James Outman's going to be a first round pick next year? You know, kind of tongue in cheek there, but like, you know, like if someone's offering you a really irresponsible package for Outman, then you could sell high on him. But I'd also, if someone, like if CJ, if you put James Outman on your block, on your trade block today, and I had time, I would maybe reach out and see what you were looking for. Because if your whole goal is, I got to cash out James Outman now, then I think someone could get the better of you in a trade and they could buy high on him and you might be selling, you might be in too much of a rush to trade Outman. So I think he's legit. I mean, he's not this good. He's not a first round pick in fantasy next year, but I think he's very legit. Like, I don't think this is a situation where like 2 months from now, we're talking about how Outman's back at AAA and that was a crazy 3 week stretch he had or whatever. Ross Redk, actually got a couple questions here. So Ross Redk asks, is Lion Richardson just beating up on weak competition while on rehab, or does the increased velo make him a legit difference making SP prospect? And then Sonny says, everyone's talking about Andrew Abbott and rightfully so, but how high are you on the guy who was promoted to AA behind him, Lion Richardson? So Richardson, arguably has louder stuff than Abbott. He's touching 99 miles an hour. You know, I think he was up in that range with the fastball as an amateur, and then was more kind of low 90s pre Tommy John surgery. Now he's back from Tommy John and he's back up to just kind of sitting in the upper 90s, touching 99. His slider has been a big time weapon for him. I know Chris Blessing just sat in on Richardson and had some video out there on the slider. You know, so it's, he's got the two pitches. He's having a ton of success. He got the bump up to AA. But let's see sort of how the command is at AA. Let's see how the third pitch is at AA. Still a lot of reliever-ish traits with Lion Richardson, but big up arrow next to his name. He'll be on the top 400 on the next update. And I'd say you could probably value Richardson right now as sort of a borderline top 200 prospect, but you know, a lot can change, especially for a guy like this, between now and when I do the next update in about a month. Ross Redk, what's your read on Tyler Black at this point? I thought of him as a boring hit tool guy, but offseason reports indicated his speed had ticked up and he's running early, and now he appears to be making a concerted effort to lift and pull. Is there some sneaky upside here? Yeah, Black has really improved his stock. you know, he's just doing the one thing, and kind of mentioned it with the effort to lift and pull. We knew about the OBP skills. We knew about the high walk rates. We knew about the speed. That none of that's new, but the fact that he's actually getting to impact power in the early going at AA is, that moves the needle a ton, because he's going to have to do that to be more than just sort of a utility guy. And the Brewers depth chart could be a little crowded by the time Black's ready. Probably not this year, but sometimes guys that have just this kind of control over the zone, they can move fast. So if Black's still out there in your dynasty leagues, his stock's trending up. I mean, he's got to be rostered in pretty much every dynasty league at this point. And he's more valuable in OBP leagues than batting average leagues, but he's still fine there. The power is the big thing with him, and that's what really caught my attention when I was looking at him a week or two ago. All right, Ross Redk, I wasn't overly excited about Sterling Thompson coming into the season. Sterling Thompson with the Rockies, he was the top 40 pick last year, but he's destroying high A. Do any of the tools appear to be better than expected? The low swinging strike rate makes me think maybe scouting reports were light on the hit tool. So Thompson's hit tool is actually that's like all there is to him, really. Like that's why he was drafted on day one. That's the reason he's ranked on the top 400. So I don't know what scouting reports you're talking about, but if you saw scouting reports that weren't high on his hit tool before the season, then yeah, those weren't very accurate. But he hit 354 with a 50% strikeout rate his last year at Florida, which is really good for an SEC hitter. In his draft note, I said that he had one of the better hit tools among college outfielders in the class. So the hit tool with Thompson is the thing, and it's been the thing. But all that said, he's at high A, and he turns 22 in June. So he's old. That's old for the level for me, for a legit prospect. You know, guys from the SEC from last year's draft, like, we got to see at double A before we can really say anything with confidence. And then you factor in he's playing for Spokane, and I touched on this a couple podcasts ago. And Spokane is just a super hitter friendly park. So Thompson's older, he's playing for Spokane. Obviously the strikeout rate's great, strike rate's great, but I think it's going to be hard to evaluate any of these guys. As I mentioned with Sam Dykstra a couple weeks ago, that outfield's loaded with real prospects, but just the hitting environment there, especially for Thompson and like Jordan Beck, who's also a college guy, like, it's just, you expect these guys to put up crazy surface stats, right? Like, there's no excuse to not do that where they are. And Thompson's just kind of performing maybe at a higher statistical level than you expected coming into the year, but none of this is surprising. This isn't like Thompson's like a top 50 prospect now or something like that. I think we got to see him at double A before we get too excited. And Thompson is most likely a left fielder too. So like he's got to hit. All right. Franklin D. Roosevelt, what are your expectations for Brennan Davis at this point? There was a chance that, like, what I was hoping for from Davis is that he'd come back to AAA this year after dealing with all those back issues, and he just breaks out, like, right? Like, he's a post-hype breakout. Everyone's getting excited. Like, Brennan Davis is back. It's a really small sample, but it doesn't look like that's happening for Davis. His run at AAA actually reminds me a lot of Joey Weimer's run in the big leagues for the Brewers, where the strikeout rate is much lower than anticipated, but they're sacrificing impact for contact. And that seems to be what's happening with Davis right now. It's like, you know, the hit tool, maybe it's better, but there's just not enough impact there relative to his physical tools. And he'll be 23 this whole year. But that's, you know, if he doesn't show some signs this year, I don't know. It's looking like he wanted to know what my expectations are. I would say the odds are against Brennan Davis turning into an everyday player at this point. And yeah, just a bummer. I was too high on him. I think part of it is just the back issue has really been a big problem, but yeah, I was too high on him a couple of years ago. Okay. Ryan asks, do you intentionally diversify your early season prospect pickups, especially on the pitching side? I found myself spreading pickups out on guys like Justin Lang, and low A with the Yankees, Jacob Miller with the Marlins, Trace Bright with the Orioles, Bryson Motz with the Cardinals. So do I diversify my early season prospect pickups? I'm only in four dynasty leagues, and I'm only in two leagues where that caliber of pitching prospect is worth adding. The high upside pitching prospect who's like 3 years away from the big leagues. So I don't really need to worry about diversifying, since there's only a couple leagues where I would even be considering those types of guys. But that said, I'm more likely to just load up on the guys I really believe in and hope to be right more often than not on those guys. Like, you know, all prospects are super risky. If you picked up Justin Lang and he blows out his elbow, you know, that it, I don't think it's bad process to have picked him up in three leagues instead of one league. I mean, you should be expecting all those guys to just amount to nothing, right? Like, they're pitching prospects at single A. So I don't think diversifying makes that much sense. Like, especially if you have a preference, like if you just can't make up your mind and you think these four guys are about the same, then sure, diversify. But I don't, I don't really worry about that. And if it's a prospect I really like, I want them in all my leagues. One guy that I think fits right into that mix too is Frank Mazzucato with the Royals. He's been one of my favorite arms to watch this year. He'll be a big riser. Bad prospect ranks has a question. when are we, the people, going to discuss Dylan Lyle of the Nationals as a prospect living up to his draft pedigree after recovering from an injury? Early results look encouraging. Yeah, Lyle, he was generating some buzz in the spring, and he's definitely impressed so far at single A. Lyle, I think, is a clear top 400 prospect at this point. We'll see where he ends up on the update in about a month. So there's a potential for five category production with Lyle. That said, he's 20 and he's at single A. And single A is just, it's a really easy level right now for pitchers and hitters to put up good stats, especially if you're 20, 21. So we want Lyle to get the bump to high A here in a couple months. I don't think they'll do it right away, given the missed time that you mentioned. But I don't see him making like a massive jump until he kind of does what he's doing right now, but at high A. Okay, got some Connor Norby questions. David M. DiCenzo, given some recent struggles and the young infield talent in Baltimore, can Connor Norby still have a positive impact in MLB this season? And then Russ Hinnan, any chance Connor Norby is getting surpassed in the pecking order for Baltimore? Lots of middle infield prospects in the system. He's been okay, but not great at AAA start of the year. Norby's been pretty impatient. Norby's stats look like Connor Norby's trying to hit his way to the big leagues rather than just kind of treating it like a process, which, you know, I can't blame him. I don't want to be in the big leagues too if I was at AAA. But if the Orioles, like, let's say that today the Orioles are like, we got to call up an infielder. Someone's hurt. We need one of our AAA infielders to come up. I think it would be either Joey Ortiz, who's on the 40-man roster and is the best defender of these guys, or Jordan Westberg, who's not on the 40-man roster, but has probably had the best start to the year of these guys. So I think Norby would be behind Ortiz and Westberg for a promotion if that promotion was coming today. But it's also April 26th. And the Orioles aren't going to be calling up any of these guys today. And so it might not be till like June 20th or something when they're like, all right, we're going to dip into our infield depth at AAA. And like Norby could be the hottest hitter in the minors in the month of May. So it's just, we don't know how it's going to play out. If they dipped into that depth today, Norby would be sticking at AAA. I'm pretty confident in that. He's also the worst defender of those three, so that matters. Definitely shouldn't be stashing Connor Norby in redraft leagues. He's a dynasty guy and a watch list guy. He should not be on any redraft benches right now. Will Bell, when does Jackson Holliday become your number one prospect? He says, joking, sort of. And then what do the Orioles do with all these middle infield prospects? And do we see Colton Cowser debut this year? Next month or the month after, I should just do a Orioles only mailbag episode, because I honestly think I could get enough questions for that. But Jackson Holliday, he could be my number one prospect by the end of the year. Like, that's in play for sure. Like, he's got that look. Like, you watch Jackson Holliday, he looks like a future number one prospect, certainly a future number five or top five prospect. He's just the real deal. Nothing bad to say about Jackson Holliday. He's kind of on a rocket ship right now. And I tweeted out a picture of the early hard hit data we've got up on the site. And there are a bunch of, you know, impressive guys on there. Junior Caminero obviously was on there, but like for Jackson Holliday to have the same type of hard hit rate at single A as a teenager as some of these like DH types have at AAA, it was just wild. So Holiday's awesome. And then how does what do the Orioles do with all these middle infield prospects? You know, I think we see Ortiz and Westberg at some point this year, might see Norby sometime this year. But you know, they could trade a big leaguer. They could trade prospects. They could trade a big leaguer and a prospect. There's all kinds of stuff they could do here. It's going to be a very annoying situation for fantasy if you don't have what, like, Adley Rutschman is not going to be an annoying guy to have in fantasy. And I don't think Gunnar Henderson will be either. He is right now, but I think long-term Gunnar Henderson is a monster. Jackson Holliday is going to be a monster. So some guys won't be affected by this, like Wander Franco and Randy Arozarena are fine in Tampa Bay, but this could be kind of they're building a better version, kind of what the Rays built. And so there's just going to be guys who don't get as many plate appearances as we wish they would. And, you know, if I have Connor Norby or I have Joey Ortiz or I have Jorge Mateo, even, like, I'm hoping that they get traded to another team because those guys all project as, you know, guys who are playing every day on a middle of the pack team or a bad team. But the Orioles just have so much depth right now. And then with Couser, I think we see him at some point this summer. I do think we'll see Kyle Stowers first, unless maybe it's like a Cedric Mullins injury and they just need a center fielder. But again, this is not a perfect situation. Like, I think Couser, part of the appeal with him is that he's just the Orioles' leadoff hitter and he's hitting in front of the Gunners and the Adleys and stuff. But, you know, I don't think we'll see Couser necessarily when he's ready. I think we'll see Couser when the Orioles are ready to kind of give him a spot, which aren't the same thing. Andrew Price, what are your early impressions of Cole Wilcox and potential ETA? Love what Cole Wilcox is doing at AA. The Rays jumped him over high A completely. He's not even generating ground balls at his usual clip, and he's still been dominant. Wilcox is probably behind Mason Montgomery, who I like even more among their AA arms, but I think we'll see Wilcox in the majors sometime next year if he stays healthy. Really good story. And I've added Wilcox in the Highlander this past week. So if you're looking for an upper level pitching prospect and you're in a shallower dynasty league, Wilcox is definitely a guy to go grab. Charlie's. Oscar Colas seemed to have earned his playing time from spring training play, but he's been scuffling. Any concerns long-term? How about the play of Josh Lowe and Cody Bellinger? So Colas is, this kind of ties back to Eric Holterman's question from the beginning of the show, but this was kind of a clear case. And I would even put Anthony Volpe with the Yankees in the same boat here, but kind of a clear case of a team sort of making up their mind on a player rather than it being kind of a ironclad process. Like, I mean, is it good process to let a guy who struggled at AAA last year to make the team out of spring training, like Volpe? I mean, maybe. Is it good process? I think the White Sox basically went into spring training hoping they could justify putting Colas on the everyday roster. Like, is that good process? Like, not really. But Colas, the number one thing Colas has going for him is that he is a player whose body can handle playing right field. And the White Sox only have one other guy like that, maybe, and that's Gavin Sheets. Like, Sheets should be a DH. Colas, you know, he's probably a good enough defender to just be an outfielder. And that gives him a leg up over guys like Gavin Sheets and Eloy Jimenez and Andrew Vaughn. Like, he might benefit just from the White Sox being unable to not load up on designated hitters. So, you know, Colas, he's got a 112 max EV this year, but he's just not doing it with any regularity. Maybe they send him back to AAA, but again, this is just terrible team building by the White Sox. They've just got all these guys who can only DH or play first base, and Colas happens to be able to play right field. So you know, I wasn't going after Colas in redraft, so I guess I'm not surprised by any of this, but it's not like I'm going to just bump him off my dynasty rankings or anything like that. Now, Josh Lowe, I think Lowe's breakout is maybe the most exciting long-term breakout in the league to me, because of just how high his 5x5 ceiling is. Like, this is a guy who could very realistically go 30-30. Like, the tools are just obviously there for him to go 30-30. Big question is, like, the Rays now have all these outfielders now that Jose Siri's back. So I feel like Lowe probably isn't going to play as much as we want him to. But long-term, I'm just so excited about Josh Lowe. Love what he brings to the table from an upside standpoint long-term. And Bellinger, just, you know, wow. Really hard to pick holes in what he's doing. You know, he's not going to hit 300 all year, I don't think, but he could be a guy that wins fantasy leagues this year for people. Like Cody Bellinger, you know, he could finish as like a top 15 player on the player radar. He's done it before. He might do it again. Props to him. And he's going to get if he stays healthy and just doesn't turn into a pumpkin, he's going to just get a massive payday in the offseason. Ryan Veneman, would you trade Mason Miller for Brandon Nimmo straight up? And then he says he's rebuilding. He's last place in his dynasty league. So I think Nimmo should have more dynasty value than Mason Miller, given just the uncertainty of, like, we don't know if Miller's going to throw 100 innings in the big leagues this year, 125 innings in the big leagues this year. Like, he might get hurt his next time out. So I think the uncertainty from a volume standpoint with Miller, and then just kind of know what you're getting from Nimmo. He hasn't been the picture of health either in his career, but I think you at least kind of, you know, he's a position player and you know what you're getting. So he could break down, but less likely than with Miller. So I think Nimmo should have more value in a dynasty league than Mason Miller. But if you're rebuilding and you're in last place, you're basically trading for Nimmo to trade him again. Like, you're not going to keep Nimmo on this rebuilding dynasty team for the next 2 or 3 years, or you shouldn't. Like, you would be getting him to flip him. So if you think you can turn Nimmo into a better young piece than Mason Miller, then you could trade Miller for Nimmo and then make another trade, but not the ideal guy to go after if you're last place team. But Miller is also not the ideal pitching prospect to have. Like, at least to me, like, if you're multiple years away from contending, you can't bank on Miller being healthy at that point or being built up to like 160 innings at that point. Antonio Andolini, is Luis Ortiz a must own? And which two would you keep out of these three? Brandon Pfaadt, Mason Miller, Tanner Bibee. I mean, nobody who's out there on waivers in your league is a must own, but Ortiz has a high ceiling and should make double digit starts this year in the majors. So I think he's a fine stash. Just kind of comes down to how many bench spots you have, who are you dropping. I would take all the guys you listed after him over Ortiz. So Pfaadt, Miller, Bibee. I'd want Pfaadt and Bibee in dynasty, and I'd want Pfaadt and Miller in redraft. Jim Delaney asks, do you believe the reduced K rates of Nolan Gorman and Matt Chapman are real? So Gorman's gains in the strikeout department seem more significant and sustainable to me than Chapman's. Chapman hasn't even really cut his strikeout rate a ton. The big difference with Chapman is just that his barrel rate is almost tripled. He's barreling balls at a 32% clip right now. That's not sustainable. So I don't, you know, I think Matt Chapman's strikeout rate just kind of is what it is. Like, it's probably a couple percentage points higher than it will be at the end of the season. But the big question is just, like, what does his barrel rate settle in at here? When we get to like June, July, that's kind of the big change with him. He's just, everything he's hitting it out of the park. And then with Gorman, like, I might have to take the L there. I didn't think that his plate discipline numbers would be where they're at right now. And I just thought that was such a crowded situation. I kind of expected him to be the odd guy out because of the hit tool, but instead he's making it work. He's just doing a ton of damage when he does make contact. So I think he can, you know, as long as he kind of keeps that walk rate around 10% and strikeout rate under 30%, I think Gorman can just do a ton of damage. So I'll probably end up taking the L there. Although I think it's too early in the season to take official L's. I've made that mistake in the past, but I'll be willing to take that L in weeks or months or something like that. Leo Kelser, what is your take on Jake McCarthy? Was widely viewed as a breakout candidate going into the season, but results have been very poor. Hope for a turnaround or throw him back? I definitely take issue with your phrasing of was widely viewed as a breakout candidate because I mean, to me, at least like the people that I talk with and follow, McCarthy was he was widely viewed as a potential bust candidate going into the season. Like, so I thought he was extremely divisive coming into the season. There were some people that I assume thought he was a breakout candidate. Otherwise he wouldn't have been getting drafted as high as he was. But I think in hindsight, it's very easy to kind of say that was a bad pick. There were plenty of people who were saying it was a bad pick at the time. So in redraft, I think you cut him, and in dynasty you hold him. But I don't think this is all that surprising. It's surprising how quickly McCarthy lost his job, but not surprising that it happened. FTK, what are we doing with Riley Green in dynasty? Am I just stuck with his striking out ass for the long haul? You're stuck with Riley Green unless you want to sell really low on him. I think Jared Kelnick and Josh Lowe are some pretty good examples of why being patient with this caliber of player can pay off. That doesn't mean that it will pay off being patient with Riley Green, but he's over a year younger than Jared Kelnick, and he's over 2 years younger than Josh Lowe. He's still 22 years old. So I think Riley Green, you know, he might be a great buy low in dynasty. So I think you are kind of stuck holding on to him. Tom Braun, with Jose Urquidy scuffling, is it crazy to contemplate dropping Kyle Bradish for Forrest Whitley? Yes, I think that'd be pretty crazy. I know Bradish is coming off a terrible start. I know that because he did it in a bunch of my lineups, but that's probably his worst start of the season. And Whitley had those great first two starts at AAA. He's been kind of so-so in his last two. So just by Whitley being on the 40-man roster, he could be the guy if the Astros need to get a guy from AAA to hop into that rotation. But Whitley, just the volatile. If you didn't like what Bradish did last night, I think Whitley could be extremely volatile on a start-to-start basis in the big leagues. His stock's up. Like he's back to being kind of a guy that I do want to have in dynasty, but I don't think you can drop Kyle Bradish for him. Phil Kramer, Everson Pereira was dropped in my 20-team dynasty league where we roster 9 minor leaguers per team. How concerning has his performance been? Is he a must-add? Several top 100 industry-ranked prospects have been dropped in the first 3 weeks based on performance. So the fact that it's 9 minor leaguers per team, you know, I could see you having 9 prospects that you don't want to drop for Everson Pereira. So it kind of comes down to who's your worst of the 9 prospects. I think Pereira should be rostered in a league where 180 prospects are rostered like yours. It just kind of comes down to who you're dropping to add him. He's been so streaky in his career. I just don't want to overreact to his start in 14 games. Like Everson Pereira's start to the season is just a classic example of why I don't update my prospect rankings in April. I do those right before Memorial Day, the end of May. So, but at that point, like if Pereira's got the exact same slash line, exact same strikeout to walk and everything like that. He'll be lower on my update next month, but there's a lot of time between now and then. Danny J, should I view Hector Rodriguez with the Reds as the next huge helium teenager? I don't think so. He's a 5'8" center fielder at single A, and you know, it's nice that he's got 3 home runs already. That's more power than I would have expected him to have shown so far this year. But that's, you know, I don't think he's a massive helium guy. He might be a little underrated in some circles, but Jason Q, pick 2 to hold from Jackson Chourio, Ellie De La Cruz, Jackson Holliday, and Evan Carter. I'll hold Jackson Chourio and Jackson Holliday. Danny J, Cody Bradford's stats rule. Could he be a sneaky dynasty ad? So Cody Bradford, a lefty in the Rangers org. He made 26 starts at Double A last year and got did not get selected in the Rule 5 draft. Lefties with really good changeups can sometimes just put up numbers in the minors that oversell their big league potential. I think you could add Bradford in a dynasty league. I don't think that's crazy, but he's more of kind of like a back end starter. Bobo B, after moving Casey Schmidt into your top 100, any second thoughts now, given his relatively punchless performance so far in AAA? Yeah, I mean, Schmidt would probably move down if I updated the rankings today, but I doubt he'd move down enough to get like a red down arrow. I'm more concerned with his lack of walks than his lack of home runs. Sacramento is the least hitter friendly park in the PCL, so I think the power will show up with Schmidt here in the coming weeks, but you know, you don't want him to be like a 2% walk rate guy, so that would be my main concern there. All right, this has been another end of the month mailbag episode. It's RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast brought to you by Rival Fantasy. As I said, I couldn't get to all the questions you guys asked. Really appreciate everyone who sent a question, but I will get to almost all the questions you guys asked in the article version, which should go up on the site Thursday. So thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll be back with you next week.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.